Yeah, some, I did. Now, some of them you dial the conference code and then the moderator code. Others you just dial the moderator code, and I didn't know which way this one worked. And now I've had ones where you dial, and it says if you are the moderator, dial the moderator code. Hello?
Hello?
Are we on yet? Well, it's not at 8 yet either. Hello?
Hey, it's Jeff.
Hey, Jeff, how are you doing?
I'm fine. We have anybody on the line?
Rick Wasner's here.
Rick's on. Cheryl will be on momentarily. And yourself.
Okay. So it's going to be a small group tonight, so it'll go pretty fast then, right?
Well, that just depends. We shall see. Somebody else just joined.
That's Ann.
Hey, Ann.
Hey, Ann. It's Jeff. I had
hey, Jeff. How you doing?
I'm doing good. Are you?
Oh, in weather like this, it's really nice.
It is up. When do we want to get started today?
Well, I would go... Let's give it about 30 seconds. Get one more person on, and then we'll go for it. Cheryl.
What are the topics tonight? Just me?
Yeah, you're the entree. And shoeing issues, and particularly how to shoe for posture changes due to either maturing, wear and tear over ride season, etc. So,
Rick, where are you from?
Illinois.
Illinois.
Uh-huh.
How's the weather in Illinois?
It's been pretty nice lately, running up near 70.
Hi, Cheryl joined.
Hey, Cheryl.
Hey, Jeff.
Rick, Donald, have we met?
I was at a clinic, APEC clinic, and you were there, but I don't think we ever talked.
Yeah.
I was just auditing.
Just as a starting point, I think it would be useful to, in effect, have, you know, is there a technical definition that you, or some sort of definition you can put around posture, and then maybe from there provide some examples of how you would evaluate posture, quote unquote.
Well, posture in the equine is you know, each individual horse is going to have a different posture. It's not like us humans, you know, shoulders back straight, shoulders up, you know, carry a glass of milk on your head kind of thing. Because each horse has a individual type of posture that is unique to its conformation and way of going. And, you know, in most horses that aren't sport horses, the posture changes are so slight, they're never realized. You know, they're not using the horses enough to know or realize what changes they are affected. Does that help, Cheryl? Is that kind of what you're looking for?
In some, that's at least what I would call maybe a start. And somebody joined?
That's Deborah Ritz.
Hey, Deborah, welcome.
Thank you.
We've got Rich Wasner and Jeff Pauly on the line. And we're just sort of, okay, what is horse posture?
Yeah.
Okay.
And Ayala also, and then
yeah.
Stag and Cheryl.
Yeah.
Did you say Carrie Ridgeway was there?
No, Deborah Ridge.
called Deborah Ridge. Okay. And what I look for in spores is if you start getting subtle changes in the feet due to environment, wet weather, you know, dry weather, you got a little flare, a subtle flare somewhere in the foot that you never had before, there's a reason for that. And the feet show everything. The feet will tell you when something is not centered anymore. And us as farriers tend for that just rasp it off and never communicate that to the horse owner, and then we never head it off. It's a red flag that needs to be discussed. And a prime example of that is Super. You know, Super was having some issues, and we've talked about it for a year, and we've done things that we never could pinpoint what was going on. And then luckily, Jim in Florida found it, and Super's posture completely changed, and when his posture changed, his feet changed, and it's that immediate. I mean, you can take and try to force things. You can try to force shoulders and hips and try to push them through feet, but that is never, I've never had any success long term with that, because if you don't fix the problem, then all you're doing is putting the Band-Aid and creating more problems. And us as equestrians, when we discuss, when I'm there showing people's horses and we're talking about subtle changes, my horse is not liking his right lead today, there's a reason for that. You know, it's different reasons every time. It doesn't have to be the same reason. And it's the horse owner, the farrier, the veterinarian, whomever is involved, responsibility to work as a team to try to benefit the horse. And it's not the farrier's responsibility on his own to try to give you the best hoof care if you're not doing things to help him and provide him good health care, hoof care. Does that make sense? Is that okay?
Yeah.
You've almost gotten to the conclusion before I've got the problem stated, though.
Well, I'm just trying to get people to think in the mindset of where they can ask and give me technical questions I can answer. You know, I can give you examples, but it may not be an example somebody wants to hear. So I'm trying to get everybody thinking of the same thing where I'm at, and then we can have a good little conference on posture and how it affects feet.
Yeah, and part of this is part of the reason why I want to start, you know, what is posture, then how would you evaluate or assess or even look at posture?
It's individual
to the horse, but it's like, where are you looking? Are you sitting the horse up square? All of the above? None of the above?
Yeah, not all horses are square. Very few horses have a conformation to where they'll ever be square in their feet. What I look for is, are your shoulders? Is one shoulder larger than the other? Is one hip higher than the other? And does he carry his head to one side or the other? Is his head center with his withers? Is his rump, is flowing in center of his withers? You know, is everything center lined down? And is he flexible? Is he the same amount flexible one way versus the other? To me, to start from ground zero, when you get on your horse or when you saddle your horse, or even when you square him up in the cross tie, can he stand there and be a straight line from his tail through his ears?
So
if he's standing there with his head to the right,
a lot of us can get the horse to square up, but you get the impression, right, wrong, or indifferent, that they're not always comfortable.
Right. Can you stand there? Can you stay there in that position for 10 seconds? And 10 seconds is a long time to ask a horse to square up. And does his ears, if you square him up and do that, does his ears stay perky, or does he pin them? You know, does he act uncomfortable, like Cheryl said? but and also riding, when you're riding, that's when you can really, to me, tell when a horse is better one way than the other, and is his posture there. And the best thing to do is take a little red ribbon and tie in the middle of his mane at his pole or at his withers or both, and pay attention when you're in the saddle. Is he, when you're asking him to do a straight line, is he straight from the pole to his withers, or is he to one side? And you, as a rider, may be pushing him to one side. And if you overdevelop muscles from one side to the other, then his posture changes. Then he, therefore, his feet are going to change.
Run that red ribbon thing through again. I sort of understand
they
the theory, but I'm trying to figure out how to attach it so I get the assessment that you're...
You ever saw the dressage queens when they braid their little horses' manes and got little tight ribbons in
yeah.
the mane? Just take and weave one of your Christmas ribbons in front of the withers right there in the mane in the center, and then tie a little, weave one into the pole up there into a nice little, just weave it in with the mane right, and there you have two reference points.
Ah, straight line.
Straight line, and you'll be shocked at how many people realize that they ride off center going off that straight line. And when you ride off center, guess what happens to the horse's posture? It changes to accommodate your off-centerness, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then your muscles, their muscles get overdeveloped from one side to the other.
Okay. So.
And have you ever noticed why a horse has a, on say on his left side, his feet are bigger than on his right side, and you haven't had any kind of chronic lameness? It's because most of his weight bearing is on the bigger foot, and you could be creating that. It'll also be like that if the horse has chronic lameness, and then your chronic lameness, the foot will always be smaller than the other.
Okay. Deborah?
I'm here.
Yeah, I was wondering, do you want to ask any what I would call of the basic questions?
Basic questions. Well, we transition back and forth between shoes. And I mean, if they can stay barefoot, they stay barefoot. And then we use the shoes where we can. And, you know, they're in Florida from November to Biltmore. And I find I can keep them barefoot very successfully in the sand. And then when I get back up to New York and I have these, you know, three or four muddy days and then a week of dry days and the weather, I mean, the moisture conditions are so changeable, I have a lot more trouble with them. So I don't know, I guess maybe this isn't a basic question, but what does Jeff think about going back and forth, you know, a cycle in and a cycle out?
I like it. I do it all the time with my horses.
Okay.
You know, going... transitioning from barefooted to shoe-in and vice versa. There's nothing wrong with that.
Okay, and we've been using with Jeremy Reynolds these Cytec shoes, and I find it will really help them develop better sole thickness for a while, but then sometimes they end up getting foot sore. In fact, I think I got pulled at the Greenway because after two cycles, my mare was foot sore from them.
And the Cytec shoes, they're the wide web, kind of funky-looking shoes.
Very funky.
Yeah, to me, they create, if you got a horse in wet season, if it's dry and it stays dry, you can get away with that shoe. If you get into wet season, I know Jeremy Reynolds is trying that shoe out on the West Coast, but if you get into a wet season, the sole drops. And when the sole drops with that much web in that shoe, it has nowhere to go but into that shoe. And it's a static piece of steel or aluminum there that the horse can't get any relief from it. So therefore, he gets a little sole sore from it. I don't like that much webbing that is that rigid over the sole.
Okay. Yeah, because that was a very, very wet ride, very wet, and
yeah.
I just noticed she wasn't having the same recovery she usually does, and we got pulled at 65 miles, and she looked fine an hour later, but the next day when I pulled the shoes, I saw some bruising.
Yeah, and that's just too much sole. There's a difference in sole contact and sole pressure, and you may not have sole pressure when you nail it on, but horses grow sole the same as they grow hoof, and if that sole grows at a faster rate than the hoof wall, then you've created sole pressure. And, you know, shoes are like NASCAR tires. You know, everything in your body. I don't like going with one specific setup. I don't like going with one specific shoe because the environment here on the East Coast changes too rapidly for us to do that.
Exactly.
If you're in Arizona or somewhere on the West Coast where we don't have these climate changes, then you can get away with that. You know, that could be a good shoe for certain rides, but I definitely wouldn't consider it for a Biltmore ride or something like that, because when you come to Biltmore, it could drop 2 inches of rain on you the night before, and then now you got spongy feet and spongy toes.
Jeff, don't say that.
Yeah, that's
right.
You're giving us bad luck.
This is going to be the driest forever.
Yeah, but you know, I've been sent that shoe, and I really am afraid of that shoe in the environment I shoe in. But, you know, it's like talking to Jeremy using that shoe, and it's a little different environment out in California. I really don't like gimmicks. I like shoeing the horse for the ride, and I like shoeing the horse for the horse, and that's why I have such an arsenal of things that I try, and I'm not afraid to put something totally different on your horse for a ride that you're going to.
Well, I will say I had two horses with hind end issues, and they went through a couple cycles in those shoes, and I began to think their hind end issues were coming from their front feet because they got enough relief that they were sound again, but it doesn't seem like they can stay in them too long. Now I just have her in St. Croix with a shock tamer rim pad. And I don't know, what I've heard about the rim pads, this time I got them fused to the shoe, is that they can move around. Do you agree with that?
They can, and I use shock tamer rim pads, you know, and it's a great pad. It's probably one of my favorite pads, but I don't shoe my horses all the time in those pads. It's just that you need to have a farrier and give him the freedom to use his judgment, say, you know, I'm going to this ride and it's wet. What would you suggest to do to my horse for wet conditions? And or vice versa, I'm going to this ride that is dry. Do you have any suggestions on shoeing for dry conditions? And that shoe, if it was helping your horse, I'd transition him in and out of it. You know, don't give up on that shoe because you had one bad go because it was wet that ride. You know, if it's working, and just transition back into it and then back out of it, and don't take him out of it completely.
Okay.
Deborah, you said one of the characteristics was you were seeing slow recoveries. Is that right?
At the Greenway?
Yeah.
Yeah. She just wasn't recovering as fast as she usually does. And all day, I mean, she looked sound, and she looked fine, and frankly, not to carp, but I didn't think she looked unsound. And as I said, an hour later, because I live 2 miles away, she was galloping around the pasture. But I did notice all day that her recoveries weren't what they usually are. And she just looked a little, you know, she just looked a little unhappy at that particular vet check. And I think that's what happened. But when I looked at her feet the next day, I did see a little bit of bruising. And I just wonder if it was so much water that we went through, and it was so wet and so soft that he was.
Yeah, it poured that day.
Yeah, because we
we can sympathize.
Well, Super was having poor recoveries that day, and we think it was related to the change in way of going that Jeff has observed that was showing up. Were you saying that more in the front or rear feet, Jeff?
What's that?
Super's change of way of going, which wasn't caused by the foot, structure, but you were seeing it in the change in the foot structure. Were you seeing that in more in the rear or the front or both?
Rear.
Okay, rear.
And the thing that was happening was super is, as I know his flexibility, and I know when I get under him, and he was struggling to keep his position for me to shoe his back in. He didn't want to come as high as he normally could come in the past, and his feet were very distorted. When you watch him trot, he was crossing center line. He wasn't wide and pushing and driving like the normal super. So he was hurting in his back. And when you hollow out, it's like if your back's hurting, how do you walk? You hollow your back out, you take shorter steps and shorter strides, and you don't use your legs and drive forward. And that was what's happening with super. And posture, if you're having shoulder problems, you're going to realize more of it in the front end. If you're having back issues, you're going to realize it more in the back end.
Go ahead, Zach.
Yeah, I was going to say, for those of you, let give you a little bit of more information. What Dom Freeman, who's much more sensitive rider than I am, which, you know, if you're suspecting these type changes, one of the things to do is extremely sensitive rider.
Get a dressage queen or
yeah,
somebody.
Get somebody who is. Dom, who rode super when he got second in the North American back in 05, has very sensitive seat and actually trains with a silver medal winning FEI dressage person. She was feeling super just lifting her slightly more on the left side than the right side, you know, in her seat. And started quitting on trail on her about 45 miles out. And for a while.
At Greenway.
Again, it was at Greenway. And she felt something similar at the pre-ride in Kentucky, but there she thought he'd actually slipped in one of the banks and maybe slightly pulled something. And at first he kept up with the other horses and then he let him go. So she came in at the 50-mile checkpoint, said, you know, something's not right with Super. I want to pull him. And, you know, I told Dom, you know, I respect your judgment. You know, you're riding the horse. You can feel something. But it's got all A's from the vet.
Literally, I have the vet card.
Yeah, all A's from, you know, Wes Elford. I mean, it wasn't like these were amateur vets, right? But we told him we're going to pull him, and shortly after that, he peed dark. And then, you know, we got him back to camp, did blood work, and it was not off the charts high, but it was high, like a 40,000 CPK, and the SGOT was like 1,200. So we put fluids in him just to make sure. And so we think he was, you know, getting muscle crampy, and it was brought on by this probably change in the way of going combined with the deep sand and the water and nasty conditions. And then interestingly, and just to sort of complete the story, he then went down to fits. We had him, you know, worked on, et cetera. And he started doing the same thing at fits about 50-some miles out. And fortunately, Jim Masterson was there. And Jim Masterson worked on him at the midpoint. And said he thought he was having some problems in the lumbar sacral joint. And then
did a couple of manipulations.
He did some manipulations, you know, doing his thing at the midpoint with Super. And then worked on him at each of the next checkpoints. And he was just phenomenal the last part of the ride. And thus far has permanently changed back to the way it used to going, right, Jeff?
Yeah, and I add a little bit to that. This has been going on for 3 years.
Yeah.
Ever since he had that coronet injury on his back foot. He had a terrible, terribly puncture wound, and he changed his way of going because of the injury, and that's probably what got him out in his back, and it took that long for somebody to figure it out. And this horse is done and gets a lot of attention, and it's not from the lack of trying. It just sometimes it's hard. They can't talk to us. They can't say my lumbar joint is hurting. You know, so sometimes you just have to keep working at it. And the thing about Super, what I noticed for the last 2 years, is he pushes a lot of toe in that back end, and his back feet used to be perfect. And it don't matter. It didn't matter how far I backed his shoes up and backed his toe up when I came back to shoe that horse. Whether it be 4 weeks or 6 weeks, them toes were back forward, and that's how he was standing in his feet. And the thing is if he doesn't stand center, they don't grow center. So he was standing more on his heels with his feet up underneath him. And the part that a horse is standing, if you get medial lateral imbalance, if the outside wall grows faster than the inside wall or vice versa, the wall that is the longest is bearing the least weight. The side that he's loading on.
Intuitive.
Pardon me?
Talk about counterintuitive.
Right.
So that is, if you think about it, engineering-wise, it makes sense.
Right. So if the horse grows, and any towed-in horse is going to grow more on the inside than the outside over your six-week period, he will never grow the same amount on both sides of his foot because a towed-in horse bears more weight on the outside of his foot. And there's no way to change that. It's just every time you shoe him, you have to shoe for that and trim for that and to make allowances for that. And if they, personally, if you have a horse that is terribly towed in or if he has bad conformation, shoe him in shorter intervals or trim him in shorter intervals to where you don't get as much distortion. Because any time you have hoof growth beyond the live sole, it becomes a distortion. And the only way to keep the distortion there is to keep it raspy away. So if you got a horse that you're really competing hard and know that he's bench-kneed and toed in, take him to shorter shoeing intervals where you don't get as much deviation between shoeing.
When you say shorter, how shorter is short? Or how short is short?
Well, that's individual to the horse. I don't, 4 weeks should be short enough. You know, like when we went to Malaysia, the horses over there grew 3/4 of an inch a foot in 3 weeks.
Wow.
Because of humidity. And they just got that humidity. And humidity makes feet grow faster. Have you ever realized that? Have you ever saw that? If it's dry and arid, feet grow slow. If it's very humid, just like you, it's the same way. Have you ever noticed in the hot, humid weather, you have to cut your fingernails twice as much as you do normally?
Yeah,
it's the same way with horses. It's the same way with horses' feet. So, you know, we all have these standards that we try to go by and say, well, I've always had my horse shot at 6 weeks. But if it's hot and humid and rainy, you might want to shorten the cycle up to 4. And then when it dries out and you hit a dry cycle, go to 8. There's nothing wrong with that.
Anyhow.
Does everybody count? Not agree with that. I got silence on that.
No, I'd agree with that. Now I'm waiting for you to tell me what the best way is to shoe them for Biltmore.
Oh, you want to know how Biltmore? That's a trade secret. You have to let me shoe your horse on Wednesday before the race. Now, Biltmore, it depends. I would not suggest shoeing your horse 4 weeks prior because the weather will change. I like shoeing like on the Monday previous to the ride, and look at your weather. If it's going to be very soupy and slick, I would shoe a concave.
I'm sorry, what did you say?
If it's going to be wet, if they're calling for rain, shoe a concave shoes.
Concave? I don't know what those are.
Your farrier will know.
It's how the shoe is shaped.
Yeah, it's a concave metal. It's the way the metal is shaped.
Okay.
He'll know what concave shoes is. If it's going to be dry and hard, I would suggest your shock tamer pads that you were using. Traction and stuff has never been real critical at Biltmore. And I would shoe my horse with less expansion, because there are a lot of roots and things that can grab shoes and pull your horse's shoe off and tear his foot up and get him foot sore. So I'd fit him. That's why I like shoeing them a week before that race, because everything's on there nice and tight, and you can really pretty much look at what the weather's going to be and shoe for the weather.
Okay.
If it's going to be wet, shoe for traction. If it's going to be dry and hard, shoe for shock absorption.
Okay. Thank you.
We have had quite a wet winter up here, but we've now had quite a drying spell. Got some heavy rain, Thursday. But now it looks like we're going to have another 7 days or so.
A very, very dry.
Very dry weather. In fact, today I was getting shocked every time I touched something metal.
I was talking to Ginger today, and she was saying that there is not even a speck of mud on any of the trails around her house where she's walking her dog.
Yeah.
She said it is completely dried up.
Yeah, and Ginger, for those who don't know, she's the wife of Bill Cecil, who runs the place now, Bill Jr.
And she said that was most unusual.
Check just ahead of time, because by May 1 it could totally change, but
yeah.
Could be heading for
right now. The trails are very dry.
All the horses that I shoe for Biltmore, I shoe them the week prior. Every one of them. All my front runners that are going to race. And the people tend to overpad for Biltmore. Realistically, Biltmore doesn't need any kind of pad. I know one year I had to pad because they put down fresh gravel right before the race. And we had about, a 3-mile stretch of gravel.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I padded a lot of horses for that, and everybody was glad they did because they didn't have to slow down that gravel or move off the trail.
Right.
But that's not going to be the case this year.
Well, we hope.
We're going to work with the estate a little bit more closely on that.
But I would say, particularly for Deborah, are your horses still in Florida, or are you back up north?
No, I'm going to keep them in Florida and then bring them up to Biltmore.
Okay. Yeah, if you haven't been doing anything except pure sand, then you might want to think a little bit more about pads, because your horses won't be used to even. I mean, there is. Well, you've done Biltmore before, right?
Twice. Yeah.
So you know what River Road's like, and
yes.
Yeah, that's where you're.
That's where you can take your time, but at the same time, it can also be where your horse might get a bit foot sore.
Yeah.
Well, last year we used boots. I don't remember if Easy Boots were out yet or whether they were Renegades. I just don't remember. But and we did really well, but it was dry. And I know from Kentucky, I'm a little wary of using them when it's muddy.
Yeah, they're slippery.
They're treacherous when it's muddy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think maybe, I mean, it's circumstantial, but just seeing that Jeremy and Farzad did so well all year and so poorly there, I know some people felt like those boots acted like suction cups.
Yeah, our experience with boots is that in wet conditions, they really can pull tendons and ligaments and be suction cups.
Okay.
And that goes back to your race cars. You know, they use slick in NASCAR on asphalt that is slick. They get better traction. The Grand Prix cars use group tires, and they run in the water because they get more. You can't run anything wide web on a slick surface gives you more surface, which creates less friction.
Okay.
It's more slippery. Any kind of wide web shoes is terrible in wet weather.
Okay.
But I know at the Kentucky Cup, it didn't matter what you had on your horse. It was all true.
There you go. Rick Wasner, do you have any things to throw out on the table to poke at?
Well, I'm just curious what he just thinks of the Easy Boot gloves and Renegades and the glue-ons and all that stuff.
I got an Easy Boot glove sizing kit in my truck. I've done them. I tried to talk Ruth and Everett into using them in Vermont. I think it's a great it's a great tool to use in somewhere like Vermont because it's they absorb a lot of concussion. They're easy to put on. They're terrible to take off. I would not leave it on for a six-week cycle. Any kind of acrylic or any kind of wrap you put around the foot will sweat it, and it'll break down the tubulas in the hoof wall. It's like glues. People don't like nails. A lot of the barefooted people will glue stuff on before they'll nail stuff on, but the glue is a whole lot more invasive than a nail. A nail is the least invasive thing you could ever put in a horse's foot that will create the minimal amount of damage. But gloves are great. I like them. I use them. But they're again, not for everything. They're not for every ride.
And I know last year, Jeff, when we did Vermont, you put my guys in probably shock tamer pads or something like that in the front, and you also shod them with concave shoes.
I did.
And now, Vermont's not a wet ride, but the nice thing about those concaves is they gave fabulous traction.
And they're a little lighter than your normal steel. They're a little light, a little, because of the concavity in the shoe, you got that steel in it.
Hello?
Yeah, we're still here.
Did we lose Jeff?
I think we lost Jeff.
No, here.
Okay.
Yeah, Jeff, you're breaking up a bit, though, somehow.
Stag's right, Jeff. You're sounding like you're going through a really bad cellular coverage patch. It's conceivable your cell phone's running out of juice or something. I don't know. Did we lose Jeff? I bet we did.
Sounds like we lost him. Hopefully he'll be back on shortly. And one of the things we've learned working with Jeff is to really share with Jeff all our observations, you know, because he then puts those together with his observations about the foot shape and also, you know, walking and trotting the horse out with Jeff before he starts shoeing him if we have any concerns. So Jeff is very good at integrating the, you know, what's happening with the hoof shape with, you know, the structure of the horse and changes in the horse. And I said this one thing that had been going on for, you know, these subtle changes with Super for 3 years. Turns out we're now fairly convinced it was all coming from lumbar sacral changes that we're not sure just what started them in the first place.
We're sort of sure.
We had a saddle that got warped on us that we have a feeling might.
Hey, guys. Sorry about that. Yeah.
Welcome back. Sounds like you're actually part of the conversation.
Yeah, we actually, unfortunately, we're sort of attributing it that Super was just, you know, an 18-year-old horse and the changes were natural, but we're now more optimistic that, you know, was actually something that can be fixed. Anyway, Jeff, I was just chatting a little bit more, saying how important it is to share the rider's observations with the farrier, so the farrier, and also having the farrier look at the dynamic motion of the horse in addition to the, so the farrier can put the whole picture together while you were offline.
Yeah.
So I'll turn it back over to you now.
Okay. Did I answer all of what Rick needed to know, or do you want to talk about that a little more, Rick?
No, just curious about what you had to say about it and like that.
I think it's a great tool to have and have it for some rides. But it's
now,
not
Rick
something.
You live in Illinois, right?
Right.
And what is the, and I've only done one ride in Illinois, and
yeah.
And it struck me it my memory, and it was a long time ago, I've got to admit, but my memory of that ride was that it was pretty decent footing. And how would you characterize the footing of most of the rides that you go to?
Pretty good. Dirt with some rock, depending on the ride. And then the weather plays a big part up in here. It was, you know, last couple of years we've been, especially last summer, we were extremely wet. And now this year we're
does it get how slick does it get when it rains, and how cuppy, ugly, sucky does it get when it rains?
Well, you have your boggy areas like that, and then you have your areas where it's just grease mud. I mean.
Okay, so it does get the boggy fogs and the.
Yeah, they're normally fairly small, short-lived, but something like that. But.
If I was your farrier, I'd probably set you up always in concave. If your horse has good feet, got good hoof wall, I wouldn't really put a whole lot of gimmicks on his feet. I would go with concave. And the reason concave is gives you such good traction, it's not the rim that's on it. It's the concavity of the steel itself, and it ejects the plug. You know, when a horse goes into the ground, he gets a plug of dirt or grass, and in a flat shoe, it sticks there. With a concave shoe, it doesn't stick there. When it comes off the ground, the plug will eject out of the shoe, and it goes back in the ground with a fresh foot, which gives you better traction.
You talked about pads, and I got the impression you were more the pad for shock absorbent versus protecting the sole of the foot.
Well, what pads do, you know, pads, there's pros and cons to pads. The pads, horses can get very dependent on it. And if a horse gets dependent on a pad, his sole gets thinner. And then once you get a thin sole, then you got to put pads on. I think pads are overused. If I got a flat-footed horse that runs better in pads, I'll put him in pads. But I don't like to create a horse to having to have a pad. If a horse has got a nice foot, got nice sole depth, and I like x-rays of horses once a year or once every 2 years where you can keep track of your sole, I try not to use them, because when you use a pad, you've created more surface, and they can't go in and get a plug. So you with a full pad, you got less traction. But, you know, like there's some horses that go better in pads. I know one of Stag's horses, if I don't do forehand pads on him, the dynamics of his feet don't do as well as they do with pads in there. So I pad him all the time, unless he's barefooted. And I have less issues with his hoof, with his feet. If I don't pad him, he tries to get a corn. And with pads, he doesn't tend to get that kind of damage to his foot, because I use the VetTech 4N most of the time when I want to do a full pad, because it sticks to the sole and stuff can't get between that and the shoe. You know, so pads can create problems if they collect sand or dirt, and it all migrates to the toe, and then you've created pressure at the toe, and they'll get foot sore on you that way as well.
Going back to the VetTech pour-in, I may be silly about this. It would seem to me, I've heard people say that it would create additional sole pressure across the whole of the bottom of the horse's hoof. And in that sense, their horses get more sore, presumably with sole pressure, than they do without having any pour-in, or if they have pads that, in effect, will accumulate dirt or stuff like that, but at the same time, they can be flushed clean and they're not always there.
I've seen that happen, Cheryl. What happens if they put too much pour? I try to pour to the bottom edge of the shoe. Bottom edge, man, the surface of the shoe that's touching the sole, and not down to the ground surface. That's called a therapeutic force when you feel it to the ground surface. And you never want to put that stuff in a foot that's got irritation. If you've already got irritation in your sole and you add, and you pour that on an irritated sole, you're gonna cripple it. You want to go to a hard pad. I've never had, the way I pour mine, I've never had sole issues. I know as long as I've poured your horses, you never had a foot horse to ever come up sole sore from a Vet Tech pour. But I have pulled Vet Tech pour out at Biltmore that's been overfilled, that's been too much. And I know that Meg Sleeper uses Vet Tech pours in her horse's feet for most rides that she's trying to pad for. And Dave does the same thing. You don't over pour. You just put a layer in there that gives you protection but doesn't give you static load.
Okay.
If you give a horse static load, then you're creating something he's not used to, and you can get him foot sore. Does that make sense?
I had one veterinarian try to convince me that you're actually better off using harder sole packing than the more flexible stuff. I don't know what you think about that.
Well, that I'm very aware of. It's demographics. If you're in a dry area, it's for some reason, you talk to Vet Tech, and it's a small community, and we do a lot of clinics, and we talk, us clinicians talk at dinner. And if you talk to Vet Tech, they sell a lot of the hard, rigid stuff on the West Coast. They sell a lot of the soft material on the East Coast. We have soft soles here because their natural environment is a little bit wetter than the West Coast, so the feet are a little more spongy, right? The soles are a little more soft. So you try to give them what's the closest to the natural thing that you can give them. If you're pouring a horse that comes out of Arizona, you give him the hard, rigid stuff because that's what his sole is. If you pour him in Iceville, North Carolina, we got soft soles, so why would you pour hard stuff in there? Because it's not what he's used to, so you're going to hurt him. So we tend to use the softer stuff on the East Coast, and they tend to use the harder stuff on the West Coast. Does that help?
Yes.
Yeah, if you're having a drought, if you're in a drought situation and your horse's soles are like rock, you can't cut it with a knife, then you can use the rigid stuff. But if it cuts like butter and you put a rigid pour in there, you're going to hurt him. He's not used to it.
Well, I was surprised because it was a veterinarian down here in Florida, and, you know, it's almost never really hard. I couldn't call it hard here unless you're saying that's
yeah.
What Sam does under their feet. But
He's going off someone else's experience, and if I have questions like that, I call Vet Tech and ask them. I said, well, you know, what's your tendencies? And that explanation is not a Jeff Pauley explanation. That comes straight from the technician at Vet Tech. So, you know, they're smarter than I am. They develop the stuff. They get to see it all over the world. So they're going to be a lot smarter than me. So when I get questions like that, you know, just call the people who create it, and they'll give you a better answer than a veterinarian or a horseshoer.
Okay.
Heading back, at least temporarily, to posture itself, the way we were talking about it, you look at the static posture, then you look at the dynamic posture, and in some senses, you gave a couple of what I would call the quick examples, and we dealt a lot with Super. But at the same time, it seems to me it wouldn't hurt to sort of go through, okay, this happened on the hoof, and this is what happened above, or vice versa. This is what happened above, and therefore this happened in the hoof, which you might call I don't know if there are such things as common examples that you've seen.
Well, common examples that I see is hoof distortions that are abnormal. If you're using the same horseshoer and the feet are changing, and he doesn't have a good answer to why the feet are changing, then I'd look upward above the knee. And a lot of people try to shoe for posture, and it will work short term, but that foot is very elastic. If you're pushing on a shoulder or if you're pushing on a hip and you don't fix why you're having to push on it, the hoof capsule will distort. And when you get that flare, if you got a flare, and say you're pushing at 3/8 of an inch, the foot will flare 3/8 of an inch, and now that pad that you have on there is no longer helping you. The hoof capsule has distorted itself to where you might as well not have anything on the horse. Me, you need to fix the root cause, and the classic examples is abnormal hoof distortions that your horse has never had before. You're using the same horse you're. He's scratching his head, you know, why am I getting this every 6 to 8 weeks? Then you need to start looking upward. Does that help?
Yeah. Girl?
But the classic basic example of hoof capsule distortion to a posture issue is abnormalities that are new to your horse. I've never had a toe flare. Well, why do I have one now? Well, he's changed the way he's standing. And he's changing the way he's standing because something's hurting him.
Okay, now, this is sort of, there's this degree of continuity that we're assuming that we have with our horses, which in general is a good assumption.
Okay.
Shift this out to a little bit. You got a new horse, and you're looking at its feet, and frequently feet are not necessarily perfect. And I'm thinking when we first got Super, he probably was a bit asymmetric, and certainly when we got Winston, he was definitely asymmetric. And even my charming Orion wasn't the greatest symmetry. About the only horse that we've ever had that had really good feet when we first got him is Chrome. And at the same time, it's you look at these horses, and how do you tell, how to phrase this properly, what it is that you're going to have to live with? In other words, like with Winston, I think it's you have to live with this. Because he's got a club foot, and it's not clear that anything that you do is going to change that. So you're always fighting something. And at the same time, as we have learned with Super, if we'd gotten him, say, after his hoof wall had grown out and at the same time he was flaring all over the place on his rear hoof, how do you tell what's bad?
Mechanical.
What's something that...
Us in farrier terms use mechanical is what is there mechanically that we can fix. And the best thing that you can do is trial and error. And you can fix, it's like Winston's high-low. He's not got a true club. It's called a high-low. And his clubby foot is no longer as clubby as it used to be.
That's for sure.
And the thing is that his habits have changed. A clubfoot horse, the club when he's grazing, that clubfoot is always back. He's always on the toe. So if he's grazing, he's always grazing, standing on that toe, that particular thing, his heels are going to grow, right?
Yeah.
So Winston, through his athleticism and your riding, has made him a little more ambidextrous. So if you look at him, watch him graze, he uses both feet, 1 foot forward.
No, he doesn't.
Take a step.
He's still one-footed.
Is he really?
Yeah, he really is.
Something has changed to where he don't grow as much hill as he used to.
Yeah, it's mainly the riding and the fact that we ride him a lot.
Yeah, and
we're pretty careful.
But what is mechanical is deviations created by conformation, and like most Arabians, most of them are bench knee or offset knee, either whichever one you want to call it, and you're always going to have a little bit of toed in, and it's like Donna Rojek says, I'd a whole lot rather have a toed in force than a toed out, because a toed in is a swimmer stroke, you know, it's an overhead athletic stroke, so a little bit of paddling is more athletic than winging. Winging inward toward his fetlocks is, you know, if you tried to swim with that stroke, it's very, very inefficient, and it's something you're never going to change. But as far as mechanics, you can keep a toed-in horse under control if you always, when you go to shoe him, know that he's going to grow more on that inside than he is on the outside. So when you balance that foot, you're always going to be cutting more off the inside. So that is something that you can control, but you'll never change the way he grows. So you're not really changing it. You're keeping it under control.
Mm-hmm.
If you got a horse that gets a toe flare, that's mechanical. That is something that can be fixed. If you got a horse that has a rye hoof, does everyone know what a rye hoof is?
No.
A rye hoof is that he bulges on one side or the other. You know, it takes a lot more shoe to cover one side of the hoof capsule than the other. It's very distorted looking.
And what do you call it?
A rye, W-R-Y. It's a technical. That is also mechanical, you know, and it could come from posture. And if you can get a horse standing more center, then you as a farrier, chiropractic, veterinarian, and horse owner can help that as well. And also another thing is one side, the horses go on diagonals. The right hind controls the left front, left rear controls the right front. Everything's on diagonals. And when you're cleaning a horse's foot or if a farrier's underneath him, if the horse is much stiffer on one side than the other, and that's mechanical. That can be helped through dressage and stretches and chiropractic, acupuncture, whatever, to free up and make the horse a little more ambidextric. Horses are like people. They're either right-handed or left-handed. And they use their favorite lead. And if you don't make them use both leads equally, then you're going to get a issue of overdeveloped muscles, and that becomes posture-oriented. So, you know, mechanical changes, if I'm a farrier and I'm trying to get rid of a flare, whether it's toe flare or lateral or medial, and we're doing everything we can do, and then we come back and it's as bad the second time as it was the first time, then something's wrong. If a horseshoer don't know what a flare is, I don't think you really want to use him. And if he's not trying to keep those flares under control, then he doesn't understand hoof anatomy and how horses produce that foot and how the way of going can create bad things in the foot. So, you know, it's a lot of trial and error, and it's a lot of recognizing flares that look abnormal, and if you as a horse owner know what looks abnormal, and when you take a little bit of it off and it comes back as bad or it's worse, then it don't matter how good your horseshoer is, he can't come out and trim your horse every day and keep that under control. So to me, abnormalities are created from the knee up, not from the knee down. Unless he's just a bad horseshoer. And bad horseshoers are very easy to recognize. Bad horseshoers don't have open minds. They don't look at different avenues, and they shoe to one kind of standard. And that's the way they were taught. They don't have creative thinking, and they don't have a scientific background that can think outside the box. And good horseshoers are always open to good suggestions. Does that help?
Yep.
Yeah, I know that Cheryl Newman and Stag Newman look over my shoulder all the time, and they're not doing it to annoy me. They're doing it because they want to learn, and they ride the horse.
Clueless.
Well, no, I mean, these guys are in the saddle, and they know the horses, and they see and they feel subtle changes, and none of my clientele that use me and they communicate with me and are on a personal relationship with me are afraid to ask me questions. And it's me. I see your horse every 4 to 6 weeks. I can't always pick up on subtle changes. You know, if Cheryl had a ride, and she's, well, you know, he really didn't want to go to his left this chewing cycle. You know, what's changed? And that, I don't take offense to that. And it's usually not anything that I've done. It's something that the horse has created in his environment. And then we get to looking at him. And we trot our horses, and we look at horses, and we talk about them. And if you're going to have a good relationship. most of the time, hoof deformities aren't created by farriers.
Mm-hmm.
They're created by the horse itself or the horse owner who don't ride straight. He rides to one side or the other. You know, there's a lot of things that are created there, and a lot of the pressures and responsibilities are put on the horseshoer, and they shouldn't be there.
I know at least in one fairly recent case with my horse, we did the Gothi 100. He came back to 12 inches of snow. He had shoes on, and they were not padded, and he balled up and basically got lame and pulled his deep digital flexor tendon. Okay, so come, like, you know, Cheryl's in total denial, and for quite a while couldn't ride the horse anyhow because, after all, you've got 12 inches of snow on the ground. And so we got to the point where I could ride the horse, and it's like the horse is lame. Strange. And eventually, after a lot of diagnostics, okay, Jeff, it's something in the hoof. Jeff comes out, and it's not in the hoof. And this is like the vet says it's in the hoof because he blocked out somewhat there. Not 100%, but somewhat. And Jeff comes out, tests him. And Jeff, when he tests the horse, he tests the horse. It was not in the hoof. So go back to the vet. We then discovered that it really was the flexor tendon much higher up. But in any case, it's a classic case of, yeah, there's something. You have to work farrier and vet and rider and owner, whatever, observers all together to try to get to the root of some of these things. Because the sooner you get to the root of them, not only the sooner that you can get the horse back to functioning, but the fewer permanent changes you're going to have in the horse's posture, that's going to impact the longevity of the horse's career too. Because once they get into habit, it's like biting your fingernails. Trust me, I know. It's a very hard habit to break. Admittedly, it's not postural, but...
But, you know, if a horseshoers that tend to shoe one way aren't giving your horses a fair chance, I like to know different ways, and I like to use my own mind and my own experiences and knowledge of your horse, you know, like backing toes up. How far do you pull a shoe back? How short does a toe have to be? How long does it need to be? Well, it's different from each demographic that you live in. You know, if I'm in Europe, over there for some reason, they get away with longer-toed horses, and when these people buy these one-bloods and ship them in, they tend to go lame here with that long a toe. It's just a different demographic. I try to get to know the horse and shoe the horse and not somebody's idea of how the horses should be shod. each horse is an individual. Each method is individual, and it's all trial and error. And in my wet season, I shoe horses differently than I do in dry season. The horse's feet are a lot tighter and neater when it's dry. Wet weather, anything that grows, if he grows a quarter of an inch, that quarter inch becomes very soft, and it tends to distort. Say I pull toes back shorter in wet weather than I do dry weather. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Makes good sense.
So, I mean, good. That's why horseshoeing is easy to be successful, because 80% of horseshoers are thankless. They don't think about what they're doing. They're just doing it. And 20% of them are very successful and have good careers because they have open minds and they go to clinics and they're always learning. And how I shot 5 years ago is not how I shoot today, because I'm a little smarter today, hopefully, than I was 5 years ago. And I always tend to stay away from fads. I hate fads. Anytime somebody comes and tells you this is the only way your horse should ever be shod, they don't know what they're talking about, because you go from Florida to up north and back to Florida, horses are in totally different environments in Florida than they are in Maryland, Ohio, you know, Illinois, and they're going to have a total different kind of hoof structure.
And if you're doing the transitions the way Deborah is between Florida and upstate New York, like twice a year, and Steve and Dinah do this too. It's not all that uncommon, but how do you work that transition for them? In other words, okay, the horse is, you know, this month in Florida, the end of this month it comes up, does Biltmore, after Biltmore it goes up to upstate New York.
Well, that's a very quick transition, and if in the Florida transition, if I got a horse in the sand, I love to put a horse in the sand barefooted, because it's the best conditioning you could ever have for a hoof capsule. It gets real concave, the hoof wall gets thicker, the horse uses his foot, he feels his foot better in the sand, because it's like having a pour-in Bet-Tech pad. Every time he steps in that sand, it cups up into his foot and gives him sole contact, and it distributes his load through the whole hoof capsule, not just the hoof wall. If you're in upstate New York, there's nothing going up in there touching the hoof capsule unless he's out in clay, and it packs in. That's why I don't like horse owners to clean their horses' feet out every day. If I've got clay in my horse's feet, then I'm getting sole contact, and it's distributing his weight throughout the whole hoof capsule. But that transition, I would shorten the intervals of between the time I'd see the horseshoer. If I'd like to see the horseshoer every 4 weeks in some kind of transition like that, and I'd keep the hoof growth to a minimum. Like I said it earlier, anything beyond the live sole is a distortion. It grows and it becomes distorted. So I would keep that growth to a minimum. I'd keep it rasped away, and he'll transition a whole lot better.
Okay.
So in the long run, you're gonna pay that horseshoer's truck payment one extra time that year. Because you're going to see him more often. But your horse will benefit from it, and you'll have a whole lot less changes in his hoof capsule. It'll be more transitional than help me, Cheryl, you got a brilliant mind. If I trim your horse more, I'm eliminating distortions.
You're keeping distortion, the potential
to a minimum.
Distortion is minimized doing
right.
That. And I can see that would be highly desirable. It's sort of like you're controlling as many variables as you can while allowing the hoof to adapt to the different loading factors that it's expected to.
And
minimize posture changes is what it amounts to.
Right, and in the long run, it'll cost you less money.
Yeah, you don't, you know. I mean, it does two things for you. One, you don't have to take off as much because it's not going to grow out for as long a period. And two, it's not as distorted when you go to trim it again.
So would it make sense to put shoes on when they go back up north with the rocks and the mud and everything else? Or?
Yeah, the horses adapt. I know the studies have been it takes at least, 4 weeks to adapt to the climate.
Okay.
So when you go back up there, your first shoeing should be 4 weeks, and then your next shoeing could be 5, and then your next 6. You know, transition into it more frequently. If you have your horse shot in Florida, you come to Biltmore and race, and you go back to upstate New York, and you don't have a ferry out for 4 weeks, then to me, you're gonna have more distortions and more breakdown in the hoof wall itself, and it takes a long time for a horse to regenerate his hoof capsule from hairline to toe. So if you get a distortion halfway up your foot, because you know if it grows 3/8 of an inch and that 3/8 of an inch distorts, it's gonna pull on the lamina above that. So now you're distorted up to high for 5/8 of an inch. You know, and then you get separation, and you get trash, or if it's compromised, it's going to go even higher up. Now you're up to, you know, a third of his hoof. It's going to take you to get rid of that distortion. Now it's going to take you 3 to 4 months. Or if you shortened the shoeing interval, you corrected it before it created any damage, now you still got good foot.
Okay.
So, you know, like if I shot my horse in Florida, come run Biltmore, I wouldn't take him back to upstate New York and wait 4 to 5 weeks before I saw my farrier, even though, you know, I'd see him if I got him shot in Florida, I'd have my farrier in upstate New York see him 4 weeks later.
Okay.
From the point of time that you had him shot. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. One of the other factors that plays in that particular scenario, at least in my own head, is that you've ridden your horse 100 miles. And does riding help stimulate hoof growth?
Any kind of blood flow, anytime you're riding your horse or exercising them, you are creating more blood flow in that hoof capsule, and the more blood flow you're creating, the more he grows, yes.
Okay, so even, say, you know, 4 weeks is almost the maximum. You might even back that into, like, 3 weeks after Biltmore, given.
Yeah.
He's likely to be growing quicker.
And if you go to New Upstate New York and it's very humid, you know, he's going to grow even quicker. If it's very dry and droughty, he's not going to change much or grow much.
Yeah.
I know in Malaysia, all the horses that got there, I shot horses from the U.S., Canada, Japan, and about all the South American horses that I was under, because they wasn't, even the South American horses that came and went into that humidity in Malaysia, it was high humidity, they all pushed a lot of foot, they all pushed a lot of sole, and the horses had to be redone, and nobody wanted to redo them because they got them done 2.5 weeks prior when they got there, you know. Who cares? They got 3/8, 3/4 of an inch of foot they need to take off. I know that the UAE came in 3 days prior to the race, and they didn't have that issue.
Interesting.
So there's a big debate on, you know, when they run the Kentucky Cup, the UAE brought their horses in, 2 days prior to the race or 1 day?
1 day.
Yeah. So they don't have that transition, then the next day they ship them back out.
Well, I was going to say,
to me,
it may have been 2 days before because they had to go through some degree of quarantine, but I don't think they really went through the same quarantine.
Yeah, to me, I don't like the transition because it takes a long time for a horse to adapt, and he goes through that change. So if you can't spend 4 weeks before that race in Malaysia, to me, I'd rather go in 3 days prior to the race, unload them, and run them.
That's sort of an interesting thought. I can see the picture almost. You bring them, you IV them with fluids before you put them on the plane. You put them on the plane, you get them off the plane, you re-IV them. And then you run them.
And then you take them back home to let them rehab.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
But, you know, they have the funds, and they do a lot of experimentation, and I think that we need to pay attention to what, because they're starting to figure it out, and they're buying the best of everything. You know, they got the best veterinarians, they got the best trainers, they got the best of everything, because money's not an object. So, you know, we can lay back and watch and get this information for free.
Yeah.
But I think we need to pay attention to what they're doing. But, you know, Kentucky for us is not going to be a transition from Asheville, North Carolina, because we pretty much have the same climate. So we're lucky to be on the East Coast here in the mountains, because when we go to Kentucky, the horses are not going to have to adapt to nothing.
Yeah.
Only thing they're going to have to adapt to is Kentucky bluegrass.
I can see them smiling already.
Okay, well, thanks a lot. I have to sign off now, but it's been really, really helpful.
Okay.
Rick, how are you doing? You have other questions? Thanks, Deborah.
Sure.
No, I don't think so.
And I certainly have found this helpful. Every time I hear...
Rick, are you coming to Biltmore?
No. I'm a farmer, and I'll be planting corn.
Good for you.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay, get you down here one of these for Bill.
Well,
years for
not.
Biltmore, but unfortunately, it's the wrong time of the year.
Yeah,
for
I was going to say, I don't think Biltmore's going to change the time of the year, and I don't think the corn crop is going to change when it goes in either.
Yeah, I would very much like to get out of this area. I'd like to get down to Florida in the winter. I'm getting tired of these cold winters.
Here in Florida wasn't necessarily what you wanted to do.
For year-round climate, I've always touted where we live as sort of the best of all possible worlds.
Uh-huh.
And I always said you got any snow you get, it's only 2 or 3 inches, and it goes away within a couple of days. Unfortunately, this year made a liar out of me.
Yeah, well.
But it's still not as bad as what we've heard about in the Midwest.
Yeah, and Florida this year evidently was the coldest Florida has been in anybody's memory, it seems.
Yeah, well, when you're coming from 20 below, that's...
Exactly. No matter, it's a question of relativity.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thanks much, folks.
And Jeff, thanks so much.
Yeah, Jeff, that was really good.
Thank you, and thanks for the invite. And Ann, it's great to hear your voice again. Is Ann gone?
I think she may have dropped off a bit ago.
Okay.
But,
guys, I'll talk to you. I'll see you in a couple of weeks, and I appreciate the invite.
The Monday before Biltmore. We got horses to be shod.
All right.
Okay.
Care.
Thanks much, Paul.
All right, bye.
Right, bye.
All right.